bonjour and bienvenue to Battle Royale, where we are passing judgment on all the kings and emperors of France, from Clovis to Napoleon III.
Who will be selected as the creme de la creme, and who will be sent to the guillotine?
Je m'appelle Ben Clark.
And I'm Eliza Summers.
And Eliza, it is time for us to talk about Joan of Arc.
Da-da-ling.
Da-da-ling. However, I made the executive decision that we will not be rating Joan of Arc.
Okay.
And the reason I've decided to do that is because sort of the normal metrics don't really... I couldn't find a way to, like, apply them to her.
Saintliness.
But, like, in a way that makes the rounds sort of meaningful. Because the rounds are designed to... like, rate rulers and, like, compare rulers against each other. She's not a ruler.
Yeah.
And we've started, like, people we're talking about on Patreon, we've started not rating them. Like, Christine de Pizan, we didn't rate her because she's not a ruler. So I think we can treat Joan similarly. So while we will continue to rate sort of other in-betweeny people, Joan of Arc is a big exception.
Jeez.
I mean, Joan of Arc is an exception to just about every rule in history, which we will get to, which is part of what makes her so extraordinary and part of what makes her one of my favorite historical figures, because she's just such a weird anomaly that pops up. And also, without rating her, we've got more time to get into all of the interesting stuff in her story.
Nice.
Usually when we do kings, I end up like skipping big chunks of their life because it's just not as interesting. It's like he goes here and then he goes here and he cuts this ribbon and blah, 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 blah. But in Joan,
I don't need to know how many babies they kiss.
But with Joan, it's like she's not around for very long, but like every little detail is really interesting. So there's a lot to get into with Joan, even though she's not around for a while. So this will probably be a two-parter.
Cool,
warning you all. But we'll release the episodes close together so you guys can enjoy. Binge them together.
I'll also apologize in advance to people if my voice becomes increasingly raspy throughout this. I've had a sore throat the past
Eliza's
couple days.
Got a sexy raspy voice today. So let's get straight into Joan's life.
Yes.
We'll start from when she's born. That's a good way. It's a good place to start.
That would be. No, she magically appeared like a mushroom.
We don't know exactly when Joan was born. Most estimates put Joan's birth date around 1412, based on the age she later says she was, even though Joan herself was pretty vague about how old she was.
Oh my God. It's like when a person becomes old.
Yeah. But like, surprise, surprise, like, no one recorded the births of peasant girls in the 15th century. So it's
why,
like,
would you?
It's likely that Joan herself didn't really know exactly how old she was.
Yeah, I also feel like, you know, peasants are probably too busy trying to survive than worry about when exactly the year they were born on.
Yeah. So later saint, like, hagiographies put her birth on the 6th of January, 1412, which would make her a Capricorn. But this is likely just sort of later spin to associate with her with Jesus, because the 6th of January is the Feast of the Epiphany, which is the day that the three Magi visited King. Jesus. Yeah.
I know that from being when we were in Spain.
Yeah. And in France as well. It's a very significant holy day.
Yeah.
But it's likely she was born early 1412. Even if it wasn't the 6th of January. But we won't dwell on the, like, semi-mythological details of her early life, because a lot of it is kind of made up after the fact.
Is there unicorns or mythical creatures involved? Because I approve.
There is a fairy tree involved.
Okay, we're going to accept that as fact now. Well, there was fairies.
Well, that is factual. There was, like, a tradition in Joan's village where she and the other peasant girls would, like, dance around a fairy tree, and people at her trial later used this to try to prove that she was a witch.
Definitely accused me of being a witch. I had a fairy tree when I was little. Well, a tree I deemed the fairy tree.
By all accounts, however, Joan grew up as the extremely normal daughter of a prosperous farmer. So they weren't starving to death, her family. Her parents, Jacques and Isabel, were free peasants, so they weren't serfs, and they owned 50 acres of land around their village of Domremy. So Domremy is located on the River Meuse in the Duchy of Bar, which is in the far sort of east end of France.
Okay.
And alongside the neighboring Duchy of Lorraine, it is ruled by Cardinal Louis the First, who, on account of having joined the church, ends up bequeathing the duchy to his great nephew and later on co-ruler, who is René of Anjou, Yolande of Aragon's second son, who we've sort of met before. So the territory of Bar-Lorraine is one of the only pockets of territory in eastern France that is loyal to the Dauphin.
Oh, cool.
So popping us back into the history, we're in the 1420s. It's the time period where King Charles VI has just died and the throne of France is being contested between Henry VI, who's a baby, so it's really Bedford, his regent, and the Dauphin.
A much older person.
And the Dauphin, future Charles VII. And the Burgundians are on the English side at this point. Bar-Lorraine, this territory that Joan grows up in, is basically surrounded by Burgundian territory. Like, on three sides, it's got the Burgundian lands, and then on the other side, it's the Holy Roman Empire. So Joan would have grown up sort of knowing that the Dauphin, the future Charles VII, was her rightful king, but also knowing that the enemies were surrounded by her. So the River Meuse, on which her village sat, was itself the border between Bar and the Burgundian Champagne lands. And there's even a story of Joan's brothers getting in trouble for throwing rocks at the boys across the river, who they'd been told were their enemies. This just illustrates sort of the extent to which the divisions of the Hundred Years' War really affected every level of society. Yeah.
Not just the high-ups. Wow, we even knew he had brothers. We even knew she
had brothers. We know a crap load about Joan's family for reasons that we'll get into. So
most religious people you don't really know.
Yeah. So Joan was the middle child out of five siblings. Arc, as a surname, by the way, was not given to the family until later when they were ennobled. Which we'll get to. So Joan would never have used that name in her lifetime. As a child, she was just called Jeannette, so little Joan. And when she's speaking about herself later on, she usually refers to herself as the maid. As a farmer's daughter, Joan was sort of used to the outdoors. She had three brothers, so she might not have done much like field work. She didn't really need to. But it's likely she spent much of her time like spinning wool, looking after the livestock with her mother and her sister and like the other women of the village. And Joan was sometimes made fun of for how much time she spent at church. Even from a young age, she was very pious and she would often like trail after the parish priest seeking to make a confession.
God, I bet you they were like, oh God, she's here again.
Yeah, she was constantly asking to give her confession and, like, do penance over, like, the tiniest thing she did wrong.
She was like, I squished an ant today!
Yeah. Penance. So the Catholic guilt is strong with Joan.
In her,
But Joan doesn't start receiving what she perceives as direct messages from God until she's around the age of 14.
So he gave her a few years to have fun.
Yeah, well... It turns out years aren't super fun. So while in Western France, the Hundred Years' War is in its darkest days, with the English breaching the Loire Valley, they've taken over Paris at this point as well, and they win the Battle of Verneuil, which is one of the many crushing defeats from the French in the mid-1420s. While that's happening, Joan's family is having to temporarily abandon their land, which falls prey to a wave of raids from the neighboring Burgundians. So the villagers take shelter with their livestock in the fortress of Neufchâteau, which is a couple miles south of their village. And it's from this point around 1425 when Joan spends a brief time as a refugee. They did manage to go back home like a few days later once the raids had stopped. But It's around this time that Joan starts to hear voices. So, as Joan tells it, the signals that she's picking up, the divine signals, are coming from the Archangel Michael.
These days we just say those voices are all in your head.
Yeah. And Michael is a patron saint of France. So that's kind of why he's there. Michael is also the one who, like, banishes the devil to hell as well.
Oh, he got rid of the fun angel.
Yeah.
Fallen angel.
And Joan also gets voices from St. Catherine of Alexandria, of the Catherine Wheel fame, as well as Margaret of Antioch, who is said to have tamed a dragon as well.
Cool.
All three of these saints are kind of associated with sort of overcoming evil through, like, battle or sacrifice or, like, martyrdom or and stuff like that.
Fighting dragons.
Yeah. And at first the voices simply tell Joan to, like, keep behaving, obeying her parents. They do say don't be afraid, by the way.
Yeah. I knew it. They always do. Yeah.
They always say that.
It's like, when I start hearing voices in my head, I'm gonna be like, oh, that I'm not gonna be afraid at all. I'll be fine.
Yeah.
So
Joan is told, you know, keep doing what you're doing, keep obeying your parents, keep attending mass, it's all gonna be good. But then in a rather dramatic turn, they start informing Joan that it's her job to lead the French to victory by getting the Dauphin crowned at Reims and expelling the English invaders from France.
God, they love doing to young people, don't they? God loves putting the pressure on the young ones.
A short to-do list there.
It's like, just live your everyday life. Next day, what the F are you doing? Go get the prince bloody crowned.
Like, yeah. And this sort of escalates over the course of the next, like, 2 or 3 years. And it's really, it sounds like it's a very distressing experience for Joan.
I think I'd be losing my mind.
So she's determined to, like, do something about it. And at the age of about 16 or 17, Joan convinced one of her mother's cousins to take her to the fortress of Vaucouleurs, where she proceeded to go harass the local army captain, Sir Robert de Baudricourt, like, trying to convince him to send her with an escort to the Dauphin so she can go to the Dauphin and, like, help him lead France to victory. At first, Baudricourt essentially laughs at Joan's face. And
you can blame him, though.
Yeah, he sends her home saying her father ought to give her a smack, like, just sends her away. Over the next few months, Joan ends up visiting another 2 times.
She weared him down.
She weared him down, literally. But each time she returns as well, because, like, this is a bit of a weird thing, like a girl just coming up to an army captain and, like, yelling at him.
Can I meet the prince?
She develops, like, a kind of cult following among the people of Vaucouleurs.
So what, like, they see and they're like, Joanie's back!
Yeah, there's, like, an inn that she stays with, and like, the people in the inn, like, start to know her. And
give her discounts.
Yeah, she develops this interesting reputation in Vaucouleurs. Meanwhile, in her village, her parents have no idea what's going on.
Like, they're like, where are you going all the time? She's
and see, they're a bit concerned because they're trying to arrange a marriage for Joan at this point. And she keeps disappearing and they think she has, like, a boyfriend somewhere.
Secret lover.
So, like,
but they're just like, okay, secret lover.
Well, I mean, that's what the natural conclusion would be, is like, this girl, she's disappearing. She probably has a secret lover.
She's not going to harass the army official so she can meet the prince.
Yeah. So the second time Joan visits, Baudricourt was less violent in his response, but he still refused to see her. And then the third time, he actually agreed to hear Joan out. And he even ends up assembling a sort of hearing to sort of give her an audience. And word has spread about Joan by this point, and the Duke himself attends this council that gets assembled, which is how it is definitely possible that Yolande of Aragon may have heard about Joan long before she ever came to Chinon to visit the Dauphin, because... Yeah. She was exchanging letters with her son, who would have known about it.
Who would have mentioned it, most likely. Dear mother, the Dauphin has a crazy fan.
And this is probably also part of what changed Baudricourt's mind, because his superiors are starting to take note of Joan. And yeah, they're interested. All of this is not just because Joan had a natural charisma and a way with words. She certainly did. But she was also helped by the fact that there were rumors circulating around France about a prophecy about a virgin saving France.
Prophecies do help.
There was a woman who received visions, so not voices this time, but visions, down in Avignon called Marie Robin. And mm-hmm. she was like a renowned like seer of the time. Yeah. She had a prophecy about ostensibly a figure like Joan appearing and saving the country. And there was also an ancient prophecy made by Merlin, of all people, that France would be destroyed by a woman and then saved by a virgin. The woman, the other woman being Queen Isabeau in this interpretation.
Merlin, bad person.
So when Baudricourt's superior, René of Anjou, heard the story of the maid, connected it to the prophecy, probably what made him come to Vaucouleurs to be part of Joan's hearing.
Light bulb moment.
Yeah. I recently read a really good book called The Maid and the Queen, which is a dual biography of Joan and Yolande by Nancy Goldstone, which I talked about in Yolande's episode. Yeah. But Goldstone made a compelling case that Yolande sort of contrived behind the scenes to bring Joan to the Dauphin's court in order to help convince the Dauphin to take action in the war. Mm. Because the Dauphin at this point is just kind of sitting on his hands while France is racked by like disaster after disaster. He was racked by hopelessness, fear, anxiety. And Yolande, as we've established, is not only the Dauphin's mother-in-law, but also his most powerful vassal. So she has lots of influence. So she's the Duchess Regent of the lands of Maine, Anjou, and Provence, as well as being a titled queen in her own right, and essentially, you know, co-ruling the Dauphin's neighboring territories. So once Baudricourt had heard Joan out and he was encouraged by people around him to support her, he finally agreed in February 1429 to send Joan with an escort to Chinon, the fortress where the Dauphin currently resided. This meant sending Joan across nearly the entire breadth of France. Because Chinon is way in the west. So it's about 400 kilometers was her journey.
So through enemy territory?
Yes, mostly through enemy territory, yeah.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, so yeah, it was about 400 kilometers, 250 miles for our American friends. So they had to travel incognito and mostly at night, this little escort. Yeah. And this meant that they would avoid Burgundian patrols, but it also left them vulnerable to bandits as well. So for the journey, Joan cut her hair into a page boy's sort of bowl cut, and she wore a boy's tunic and sort of a hose rather than a girl's kirtle, both so that she could move practically over the rugged terrain and so that she was at less risk of, you know, sexual violence, either, you know, from outsiders or from the men in her own escort, because it's all just other men in this escort. Yeah. So one of her companions on this journey, Jean de Metz, says that while he admired Joan, he never felt attraction to her. She was too holy, he said. He and his men sort of could control themselves even when sleeping alongside her because she had this like holy aura or whatever. This is probably like them having to say this like to make it absolutely clear that there were no shenanigans. But
we had no sexual arousal and we saw her body.
Yeah, but there's also testimony from a woman in Chinon after they arrived who was talking to the men. And the woman later told other witnesses that, like, yeah, they were definitely looking at her.
they were definitely looking.
But nothing happened. Nothing
happened. I know.
It's just very funny that these men were like, oh, no, we didn't. No, we didn't think about anything.
How do you know she wasn't just... They weren't just looking at her because, after all, they were escorting her.
So there are a few close calls with the Burgundians on this journey, including a very risky moment where Joan insisted on going to the Cathedral of Auxerre to pray.
Of course.
Auxerre being one of Burgundy's most major fortified cities. But a few days later, they made it safely across the border to Gien and then on to the town of Sainte-Catherine-de-Fierbois. Nice. And there, at the Church of St. Catherine, Joan is said to have unearthed a sacred sword.
Knew it. It's always a sacred sword.
Yes. Now, by some accounts, this sword belonged to the murdered Louis of Orléans. By some accounts, it belonged to Bertrand Duguesclin, who was Charles V's great general, who whooped the English quite a few times. And by some accounts, it belonged to Charles Martel, which is the most popular. Oh,
I'm surprised they're not saying it belonged to Archangel Michael or something.
No, it doesn't go back that quite that far. Only to the 700s.
But like, it's not realistic if we make it have holy origin.
But yeah, this becomes the sword that Joan wields, supposedly. She will never, according to Joan herself, she will never actually like stab anyone with this sword. But she did hit quite a few people with it. She likes to beat people with the flat of her sword. So at long last, Joan of Arc got to Chinon, and by the time she got there, the court around the Dauphin was greatly anticipating her arrival. Mm. Again, people like Yolande had like let them know in advance that like this important girl was coming, and she was probably a very like a curious sort of novelty as well. And also, I'm sure people genuinely believed she was sent by God. But either way, the Dauphin's villainous chamberlain, Georges de la Tremouille, a slimy schemer, if ever we've seen one, he decided that he would try to intercept and sabotage Joan any way that he could.
No!
So the reason for this is because La Tremouille is one of the biggest rivals for power of Yolande. It's not necessarily because he's like actively trying to sabotage the French cause. It's more that he sees Joan as someone who's going to come in and like take weaken political his power. Yeah, away from his faction. So he's basically like an obstructionist is like his role in Joan's life, essentially. And La Tremouille is like, he's a bit useless. He's essentially like a glorified drinking buddy of the Dauphin. Like he basically just keeps him around because he like enjoys his company. So he's like a favorite in that way, where he's like, he's kind of useless. He doesn't really have skills to offer. He's just there. Just a good buddy. And he spent a lot of his time encouraging the Dauphin to cheat on his wife. Squabbling with the Dauphin's constable, Arthur de Richemont, who, by the way, is the Duke of Brittany's brother. So that's not a good look. Mm. So they, like, argue over military strategy. And he also, of course, undermines Yolande's authority. And Yolande's biggest fear was that La Tremouille would convince the Dauphin to call off his marriage to her daughter, because this marriage wasn't totally official yet. And that having alienated so many French allies, the Dauphin would end up having no choice but to flee France to like Spain or Scotland.
The exile.
Which is something that he was actively planning by the time that Joan reached Chinon.
Oh, wow.
So Yolande is, you know, she's pulling out all the stops. She's really desperate. Yeah, she's like, all right, let's get the Holy Maiden, see if that does anything. So Yolande, by this point, has already personally lost quite a few castles to the English. And the Dauphin abandoning her would mean there's a very good chance that she'd lose everything, basically. Because she's sunk a lot into the Dauphin's cause. Like, she can't turn back now.
Yeah.
In addition, the English have just started besieging the city of Orléans. And they've been doing that for months now. And Orléans, as we know, is, after Paris, probably the most significant city in northern France.
Yeah.
So the absent Duke of Orléans, Charles, who at this point is imprisoned in England, writing poetry, he was relying on the Dauphin, his king, to defend his territories, because he couldn't defend them himself, because he was writing poetry in England. The Dauphin was barely lifting a finger to do so. So he was torn, but so the Dauphin is like torn between the devil and the angel on his shoulder, La Tremouille being the devil, Yolande being the angel, and he's also lamenting the fact that his mother disowned him as well. He's got those mummy issues that he's working through. And the Dauphin was suspecting at this point that he might not really be the king because his mother might have cheated on his dad. So this left, all of this combined, left the Dauphin like inert and paralyzed. Is my dad my uncle? Yeah. And he was constantly praying for a sign that he was like the rightful king. So,
and Joan delivered.
Joan delivers, yeah. So, because the arrival of Joan, of course, threatens La Tremouille and might just be the thing that slaps the Dauphin out of his rut, Joan ensures that, Yolande ensures that Joan is already in the castle and securely taken care of by her own guards and servants before La Tremouille even knows that she's there. So she's kind of, she's kind of bundled in under the cover of night. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. No denying her entry into the castle.
Yeah. And news of her arrival only spreads around the following morning. And one of the Dauphin's cousins, the Duke of Alençon, upon hearing of Joan's arrival, he abruptly called off his morning hunt so that he could race back to the castle to meet her because he'd heard a lot about her. Now, Alençon will become Joan's most powerful ally after Yolande. He was a prince of the blood. He was a distant cousin of the Valois. Helps. And he was also the son-in-law of the Duke of Orléans as well. Just know that from her time at Chinon onwards, Joan sort of accumulates this whole group of like squires, knights, and generals who like swear allegiance to her and sort of stick by her until the very end.
Nice.
And they're often ones that politically oppose people like La Tremouille. But La Tremouille and his faction were still determined to make it as hard as possible for Joan to meet the Dauphin. La Tremouille had the Dauphin dress incognito as to sort of blend in with the other courtiers. But Joan, miraculously, some might say, was able to immediately identify the prince. So she walks straight up to him. She kneels before him and she says, "Gentle Dauphin, I am Joan the Maid. And through me, the King of Heaven commands that you be anointed and crowned in the city of Reims." And later in the conversation, she also said, "You are the true heir of France and the son of a king." So yeah, really hammering home the point of like, you are the king, do your job.
Stop moping around, doubting your lineage. Can't even speak.
Lineage.
Yeah, no, I couldn't speak then. I was like,
lineage. So it was really hammering home the point here. The Dauphin also arranged to meet Joan privately without any witnesses, and we don't know what transpired in this secret little meeting. But whatever Joan said, it convinced the Dauphin to lend her support.
Snapped him out of the funk.
Yeah. So interestingly, contrary to most other stories I'd read about Joan of Arc prior to this research, it's actually unclear whether or not the private meeting between Joan and the Dauphin happened before or after the presentation at court. Which, if it happened the other way around, then Joan being able to identify the Dauphin
would make a lot more sense.
Well, make a lot more sense and also not be impressive at all because she'd already met him.
Yeah.
But it would be a fun way to pull the wool over La Tremouille's eyes, I guess.
Yeah.
But I mean, at the end of the day, it's really just a sort of a PR stunt because there's like a billion ways that Joan could have figured out that Charles was the Dauphin. Charles was a distinctively ugly man. And, you know, his face is on coins. So, you know, it's conceivable that Joan would have been able to spot him in a crowd anyway. So convincing the Dauphin was one thing. Yeah. Now Joan had to convince the church that she was legit. Not only did she have to convince them that her voices came from God and not the devil, but she also had to convince them that she was a virgin. Because virginity, once again, is this weird sticking point for medieval Catholics. And it was considered that if you were an unmarried woman and you weren't a virgin, you were not.
God's not going to bless you.
Could not be saintly or virtuous. It was impossible. To undergo this examination, Joan was sent to Poitiers in the southwest, where there was a community of exiled theologians from the University of Paris. So these are people who had fled Paris to set up their own university, who were loyal to the Dauphin instead of the Burgundians and the English.
Yeah.
And at the Abbey of Poitiers, Joan was interviewed by various prelates and scholars, overseen by the Archbishop of Reims, who was also in exile. The cross-examination at Poitiers is quite funny. From later accounts that we have of it, Joan, throughout the entire process, Joan is very impatient to just get this done, so that she can do what she's supposed to do in her mind, which is to go to Orléans. Not all this nonsense. Which is to go to Orléans and lift the very urgent siege that the English are doing.
Why so, does anyone care about my virginity? For God's sake, people are in trouble.
The priests themselves don't examine Joan for her virginity, which, by the way, at the time was considered something that you could scientifically prove, which we now know is not true for a variety of biological reasons. But a group of midwives overseen by respected court ladies, notably two ladies who just happened to belong to Yolande of Aragon's household, they were appointed to examine Joan's body, and they very quickly reached the conclusion that the 17-year-old had never been known carnally by a man. And meanwhile, Joan's being interviewed by all these priests, and she lets loose some amazing little quips. At one point, she's asked what language her voices speak in, and she replied to the examiner, she said, "They speak better French than you."
I love that.
Because the guy interviewing her at the time apparently had a very strong regional dialect that Joan was struggling to understand. And then after being questioned about her belief in God, she said, "I believe in him better than you do." So when pressed to give some sign that she, you know, she was telling the truth, she sort of lost her temper. And she said, "In God's name, I haven't come to Poitiers to give signs. Take me to Orléans and I will show you the sign for which I was sent." So all of this sort of ends with the bishops in Poitiers saying, okay, Joan is clearly like,
legit.
You know, she's a good God-fearing Christian. She does all the right things. She's a bit rude, but you know, she's a peasant.
We can excuse that behavior.
And I think she's cool. I think she's fine. They didn't fully say, like, oh, she's a saint, she's sent by God. They gave themselves a bit of plausible deniability there. But they said, you know, let's at least send her to Orléans and let her give this sign that she's asking to give. Yeah. You know, what do we have to lose?
Can you at even this name point? Someone a saint when they're still alive?
Well, that is the stance of the Catholic Church today. It was a little more complicated back in the Middle Ages. Like, there's a bit of a difference between a official Catholic saint and, like, a folk saint. Really, what matters is that people believe that she's a saint, and that's good enough. Mm. So with all of these formalities out of the way, Joan is finally... She's sent back to Chinon first, and she has a second audience with Yolande and the Dauphin. And then they send her on to join the troops, who are gathering to march on Orléans and lift the English siege. So she's sent first to the city of Tours, where the Dauphin had ordered that a bespoke suit of armor was made for her. He apparently sent forth 100 livres to make this suit of armor, which was apparently, it was a shining, like, white plate armor that was actually, because it was purposely made, it, like, fit her, like, her woman's body as well.
Nice.
And Joan also ordered a white banner, which was covered with gold fleur-de-lis, and it had the words Jesus Maria and the images of some saints on it.
Nice.
And this is the banner that she would wave around in battle to inspire the troops. And meanwhile, under the guidance of Alençon, who she'd started nicknaming Le Bel Duc, the Fair Duke, because he was supposedly, well, the whole Alençon family are renowned for their, like, handsomeness, probably at least by contrast to the king. He's quite good looking. Joan doesn't call him the Fair Dauphin. She calls him Gentle Dauphin, which means, like, kind Dauphin. So under the guidance of Alençon, Joan is trained in the basics of combat, so, like, archery, horseback riding. I mean, she probably already knows horseback riding by this point, because she traveled to Chinon on horseback.
400.
And, you know, and how to use her sword as well.
Yeah.
By April 1429, so 2 months after leaving her hometown, Joan had joined the French forces mustering at Blois, which sits on the River Loire, sort of halfway between Tours and Orléans. And there she met with the general appointed to lead the relief of Orléans. Mm. And his name was John, Count of Dunois. But he is better known, both then and now, as the Bastard of Orléans. And we have met him before. He is the brother of the Duke of Orléans, the illegitimate brother.
Mm.
And he's undyingly loyal to his imprisoned brother. And he sees it as his duty to, even if he can't win the Siege of Orléans, it, at least ensure the safety of its people. And like at this point, he's actually in negotiations with the Burgundians to be like, okay, we'll hand over the city to you as long as it doesn't end up in English. As long as it doesn't end up in English hands, like it's safer with the Burgundians than it is with the English, you know. But these negotiations aren't really going anywhere. So he's very glad that Joan the Maid has shown up to lend a bit of help. So meanwhile, the siege, it started in October the previous year, and it's now April, so it's been going for 6 months.
Supplies running low.
So while she's preparing for the march to Orléans, Joan was proving that she was actually, like, kind of okay at this fighting thing. So, like, physically, she's pretty much on par with most other average soldiers. Alençon and other nobles later testify that she was, like, a natural and not only at fighting, but also at sort of motivating and inspiring the troops, which is her main role. But she's also pretty good at, like, understanding, like, the logistics and, like, the organization element of sort of being a general. The historian Larissa Juliet Taylor, who writes a biography of Joan, she doubts that Joan sort of coincidentally just happened to have this natural ability. Rather, she says it was probably through hard work and months of intensive training in the spring of 1429 that Joan sort of acquired these skills. So she went through pretty much like a boot camp on the way to Orléans. Then again, Helen Castor says that Joan only had one tactic, really, and that was attack. Go do the thing.
Well, what else are you meant to do when you're fighting
this
a war?
This is what the French need at this point, because the Dauphin the Dauphin and his generals, they've been trying to do all these like evasive things.
Yeah, they're bloody being too peaceful. She's like, just bloody attack them.
Really, she's got like this like earthbender mindset where she's like, just hit it head on.
Yes, good.
And all the others are trying to be airbenders, you know.
I just appreciate your connection there.
Yeah, all the other generals are trying to be the leaf, and Joan's like, no, be the rock.
Yes.
Be the trebuchet catapult rock with some fire. Be the melon lord.
When in doubt, be the melon lord. That's our advice to you guys.
That entire thing will not make sense to people who haven't seen Avatar.
Last Airbender. The animated version, meaning the best one and the only one that is true in our hearts.
Although Korra is where Be the Leaf comes from. Be the Leaf.
But, you know.
So continuing on, whether Joan was this military genius or just a very dedicated committed person.
It might have been a mix of both.
It could have been a mix.
It can be naturally talented, but still have to work on it.
She gave results. Let's just say that. And that's the important thing.
That's all that matters.
That's the important thing. Although she was never entirely considered like a general in her own right. Sort of functionally in battle, at least at first, she was more of a standard bearer who did occasionally end up in the thick of the fighting, but generally the commanders did their best to try to keep her out of danger.
Oh my god, I imagine her just always walking into it and they're like, no, come back.
There's one point where they deliberately don't wake her up for a battle that happens in the morning because they don't want her to, you know, rush off and like get into danger or like screw things up. And she gets pissed off and she starts storming around the castle that she's in, just like yelling at everyone.
Huffing and puffing.
So as well as inspiring the troops, Joan was also determined to make sure that the army she fought with was a moral and godly one. So as well as constantly rebuking men of any status who swore in her presence, she also, according to one of her squires, quote, never wanted to see women of evil life ride in the army with the troops, and none of them had better find themselves near her. Whenever she encountered camp followers, Joan ordered them to leave unless the soldiers agreed to marry them. Joan has a dislike for fallen women. Also old women. Joan isn't comfortable around old women. She's very comfortable around women her age who are like her status. But like old, powerful women, she feels uncomfortable around.
Oh, who can blame her? It's old, powerful women.
Yeah. So from Blois, so as she's just about to head off to Orléans, Joan also sent forth a letter that she dictated to the English regent, the Duke of Bedford. And I'll quote part of it because it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. And this is her dictating a letter, not writing, because she can't write. All Joan can do is sign her name. That's the only word she can spell is Jeanne.
It's pretty common. Yeah.
So she says, "To you, archers, noble companions in arms, and all people who are before Orléans, I say to you in God's name, go home to your own country. If you do not do so, beware of the Maid and of the damages you will suffer. Do not attempt to remain, for you have no rights in France from God, the King of Heaven. It is Charles, the rightful heir to whom God has given France, who will shortly enter Paris in a grand company. If you do not believe the news written of God and the Maid, then in whatever place we may find you, we will soon see who has the better right, God or you. Duke of Bedford, who call yourself regent of France for the King of England, the Maid asks you not to make her destroy you. If you do not render her satisfaction, she and the French will perform the greatest feat ever done in the name of Christianity." So those are some bold words from Joan.
Damn. Okay, is it weird that the second I hit when you're starting that and you're talking, she's saying, like, you know, God and all that. Mm. All I was thinking was, imagine if it was Henry VI. How he would have dealt with that letter.
Well, Henry VI is 7 years old at this point.
I mean, not the sixth, I mean the eighth.
The eighth. Well, luckily they didn't meet.
I know, but can you imagine? My God.
So if the Duke of Bedford did receive this letter, he did not respond to it, just so we know. So
left on bread.
At the end of April, Joan accompanied the Bastard of Orléans and a small force under the cover of night to sneak into the city of Orléans, both to take up command within the city walls and to bring much needed supplies to the hungry citizens. And the following day, Joan led a procession through the city streets, which saw the entire population come down to sort of cheer her arrival.
Nice.
So the following week, in early May, Joan ventured outside the walls to support the efforts of the relief force as it sort of punctured holes in England's siege lines. There were already holes, by the way, in England's siege lines, because the English army was only 4,000, and it was not enough to sort of totally encircle the city of Orléans. So there were lots of gaps, and they constructed all of these, like, fortresses that were, like little fortresses called bastides, like small makeshift sort of wooden fortresses that were sort of dotted around the edges of the city. And the English had also taken what's called Les Tourelles, which is this little, like, towery gate thing that was at the end of the bridge leading into Orléans across the Loire.
Yeah.
So Joan led out various parties to help sort of take a few of the bastides, but it was really Les Tourelles was the thing that they had to capture to really kick the English out. So Joan sort of sallies forth with her troops. They ride across the bridge to retake Les Tourelles. During this assault, a crossbow bolt glanced off Joan's shoulder, and she was quickly hurried away from the battlefield.
Of course.
But, you know, once she'd been bandaged up, she returned to prove to her troops that she hadn't died, because everyone was afraid that she died.
Yeah.
And seeing her come back,
that would lose morale.
Sort of waving her banner and shouting boosted encouragement, the troops were inspired to continue and succeed in the assault. And
nice.
Yeah, so Joan wins, and France's morale boost at Orléans was aided by a collapse in morale from the English. The besieging English force, they'd also been handicapped a bit by the fact that their commander, the Earl of Salisbury, had been shot and killed quite early on in the siege.
That wouldn't help.
Not only that, but the Burgundian support force of about 1,500 had abandoned their allies in April, just before Joan's arrival. And this is probably partly because they were negotiating with the Bastard to maybe peacefully take the city as well. Yeah. But also the Burgundians didn't want to go bankrupt over this siege, which seemed like it would be like too big an undertaking. Ages. And England, by the way, at this stage is going bankrupt, trying to keep up this war.
War does it to you.
So there are a lot of factors outside of Joan that are at play in the Siege of Orléans.
Yeah.
But it's really her that, like, comes in and takes the credit and becomes the hero of the city. You know, she was in the right place at the right time, but at the same time, that's not to, you know, discount her own talents.
Her efforts.
So the new siege leader, William de la Pole, the Earl of Suffolk, ordered the English retreat on the 8th of May, just the sort of the day after the French had retaken Les Tourelles. And this was followed by a series of small-scale sieges and battles in the surrounding area at Jargeau, Meung, and Beaugency, which cleared English and Burgundian troops from the immediate vicinity of Orléans before driving them out of the Loire Valley entirely after the Battle of Pathé on the 18th of June.
Did they eat pâté afterwards?
It's a different spelling to pâté, the
food.
Meat. Yeah, it's P-A-T-A-Y, not P-A-T-E with a thingy.
E with a thingy.
E with a thingy. So during these battles, Joan played an important role in organizing and positioning some of the troops. At one point at Jargeau, she advised the Duke of Alençon and his men to move position, and those who didn't move position ended up getting blown apart by cannons.
She could sense the cannon.
And at the big Battle of Pathé, Joan wasn't actually on the front lines. She was forced to stay in the rear guard, where she was safer. Mm-hmm. But from that position, she was actually able to rally French troops that were starting to flee, like sort of midway through the battle.
She's like, you turn back around, you fight till you die.
She apparently was able to sort of shame men who were like thinking, well, if this young girl isn't afraid, why am I afraid, you know? That was sort of her strategy, her tactic. Yeah. And it worked. So the French win the Battle of Pathé. It's the first large-scale field battle that France has won in many, many years.
Yeah.
And this just completely, like, catapults French morale into the stratosphere. And the English are just running scared. So the turnaround in French fortunes, it also encouraged more great commanders like Arthur de Richemont, who's the Breton guy who's been alienated, to sort of come out of the woodwork and overcome their disputes with the Dauphin for the greater good. Because they're like, oh, this side's winning now, we'll jump on board. And this bolsters the French army with reinforcements from their feudal territories. And on top of that, huge numbers of volunteers start to arrive in the French camp as well, despite the Dauphin being incapable of paying them. Because they all want to serve
under... volunteers.
They all want to serve under the legendary Maid, who seemed to be liberating their homeland at an astonishing speed. So with this momentum behind the Dauphin's cause, Joan saw a clear path to her first big goal, which was to bring the Dauphin to his coronation at Reims. That's what God says has to happen.
Well, the stuff she did to get to it was just side notes.
Yeah.
She's like, I don't care that I have to fight all these battles as long as I get to where I'm meant to be.
Exactly. And she and the Bastard of Orléans were able to convince the Dauphin to accompany his army, which was now 12,000 strong. So three times the force that the English had used to besiege Orléans. And while we should technically be calling him King Charles VII at this point, because his father is dead.
He's not crowned yet.
And his father has been dead for the last 7 years. Joan, like most of the people of France, still referred to him as the Dauphin. Because, of course, as you said, in their eyes, he wouldn't be fully king until the crown was placed on his head by the Archbishop of Reims in the city of Reims. As it had been for his father and, you know, grandfather, great-grandfather. Like, this is just the tradition.
Yeah.
And this is a factor that the Dauphin and many of his court sort of would have recognized, but they worried that such a merely symbolic reward might not be worth the huge risk of trying to retake Reims.
Death?
Well, not necessarily death. Like, you know, you'll probably just get captured. But the problem is Reims is in the middle of Burgundian territory, once again. It's surrounded by the Champagne lands, which are owned, you know, personally by the Duke of Burgundy and his family. And the Archbishop of Reims is on the Dauphin's side. He was at Poitiers sort of examining Joan.
Yeah.
But he's sort of been exiled from his, you know, his city. But riding the high of the victory at Orléans and Pathé, the French commanders decided to take a chance on Joan and convince the Dauphin to accompany them as they sort of carved a path through to Reims, which turned out to be the thing that the English least suspected them to do. They expected them to march on Paris, which is really not that far from Orléans.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, compared to Paris, Reims seemed to be a very out-of-the-way sort of target.
Yeah.
But the mainly Burgundian-controlled cities along the way proved to be easy nuts to crack, including the city of Auxerre, which Joan had previously snuck into to pray at the cathedral. This time she entered as a conquering hero. Yeah. And Auxerre was the only city to offer resistance, albeit feebly. The other cities just sort of fell like dominoes. So shortly after the French took over Troyes, which is where the humiliating Treaty of Troyes was signed, the treaty that basically solidified the English and Burgundian alliance. And a lot of these places simply surrendered because they didn't have sort of sufficient garrisons to defend them from the entire French army, which is humongous. But I think many of them also feared what, you know, Joan might do if they didn't surrender, because she's a witch. a lot of her enemies at this point believe that she's a witch and she has evil powers. So Reims opened its gates to the Dauphin's army on the 16th of July, 1429, still in 1429, and the exiled archbishop was reinstated in his city, where he proceeded to crown the Dauphin as King Charles VII the following day. Joan was both present and prominent in the coronation ceremony, which was rather hurriedly improvised, and it was a lot simpler than previous ceremonies had been.
Yeah, no grand.
I mean, it's still grand, but it's not as grand as past ones have been, because they had a day to plan it.
Yeah, not months.
But this is definitely possibly the most significant coronation in all of French history, because Charles is now viewed as the undoubted King of France by most of his country. And after the ceremony, Joan embraced the king's knees and wept while kissing his feet. So she's happy.
Yeah, she's like, finally, I can have a break.
So it's actually around this time that Christine de Pizan, who emerges from hiding in a monastery, wrote her Didier de Jeanne d'Arc, her Song of Joan of Arc, in which she talks about Joan leading the French to victory, the way that Moses led the enslaved Israelites out of Egypt. That's who she compares Joan to. Meanwhile, the Duke Charles of Orléans, from his imprisonment in England, he sent Joan a present for liberating his city. He sent her a richly embroidered red gown, which Joan proceeded to never wear. Because Joan continues to wear boys' clothes and will do for the rest of her life. But the message is kind of like, you know, thanks for liberating my city. Now you may settle down and become a lady. Your job is finished. Thank you very much. You may go now. So the king and the whole nobility were kind of signaling to Joan now that, like, you know, good job.
You can
like,
leave.
We appreciate you. You can go off and do your mission. Yeah, you can go off and, like, you know, get married or, like, become an abbess or something like that.
You can go relax.
And Joan at this point, you know, she was riding such a high, she could so easily have just taken a bunch of money, gone, lived her best life somewhere else. But that's not who Joan is. Joan is an action hero. Joan can't rest. And also, she hasn't finished the other part of the job that she was supposed to do, which was, you know, to kick the English out of France. The English are still in France. They still have Paris. So the way she sees it, her mission is very much incomplete. She's only just done, like, step one, basically. And now she had to undergo the second part of her task, which would prove a lot more difficult, especially since she gradually starts to lose steam and support from this point. But we will leave Joan on that high for this episode.
Yes.
But just know that it's all downhill from here, unfortunately, for Joan.
Damn.
Her tragic downfall is no less interesting and will be just as detailed as this first half of her life. There's a really tragic quote from Joan around this point where she's, like, urgently beseeching the Dauphin to go march on Paris. She says, "I will only last a year and not much more," she says. So she has this real imminent sense of, like, my time here is limited. let's do everything we possibly can. But the Dauphin becomes hesitant once again, and we'll get into the reasons why next episode.
Well, he is king now.
He is king, but he hasn't won the war yet.
Yeah, true.
So that is part one of Joan of Arc.
Woo!
What do you think so far, Eliza?
Boss lady.
He got some favourite fun facts from that episode.
Yeah, you don't want to get a letter from her.
No, don't want to get a letter from Joan. She sends more letters as well.
Oh, yay.
She really causes us quite a bit of trouble with her letters running her mouth.
Nice.
All right, and with part one out of the way...
Stay tuned for part two.
That's going to be au revoir from me.
And goodbye from me.